supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. On Monday, Villanova won its second men's basketball title in the last 3 years. Today was a time to celebrate as thousands crowded Center City to watch the Wildcats championship parade. Details from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Just after 11 a.m., the players rolled down Market Street, eliciting cheers and even a little humor.
Go Birds!
Yes, there has been a lot of winning in Philadelphia recently. Plenty of parades to show for it. Not that Justin Bianchi is complaining.
Okay, so we're counting the first parade from Nova, then the Eagles parade, then this parade. This would probably be three for me.
So is Villanova fan and employee Jessica Schwartz bored yet with the flood of titles?
You can never be too rich, too skinny, or too winning. That's how it works, dude.
Schwartz says what makes Villanova's run so special is that it's a relatively small school where the community and the team feel a close bond.
I'm obviously not on the basketball team, but I am part of the team!
And Villanova is a team, she says, pointing out how the Wildcats recovered when star Jalen Brunson picked up too many fouls in the title game.
And they had Dante DiVincenzo, the big ragu, come in, score 31 points! I mean, this is unbelievable! They truly are the best team ever.
Best team ever may be a stretch, but you can forgive Philly fans for getting carried away. Two parades in 2 months will do that to you. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Liam Heim faces state and federal charges related to interstate travel with a minor to engage in criminal sexual activity. Heim and the 12-year-old girl from Collingswood, New Jersey, were safely recovered Friday. The two began correspondence through an online chat group, which in turn is coming under scrutiny in an article in NJ Penn, an online news site covering suburban Camden County. Joining me is NJ Penn reporter Matt Skoufalis. Matt, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Let's focus on this app, Discord.
Sure. This is an app that is used primarily by the gaming community, fans of anime and subcultures like that. And it's widely available for people to form and self-select into groups, much like Facebook or other social media platforms, where they can invite everyone publicly or cultivate a handful of members. And gamers like it because it can run in the background while they play games or do other stuff.
How was Heim able to penetrate this community and use it for his own purposes?
He created a private server or message board or group or however you want to frame it, whereby he was the leader of the group. He got to decide who came and stayed. It was open to the public from what I understand, but from the people that I spoke with, about 15 to 20 of them were regular users of varying ages, many of them minors like the girl involved.
So to what extent were those 15 to 20 participants aware of what was going on in real time in terms of the development of this relationship?
Again, I spoke with one spokesperson who represented, I guess, the group of people who were there or some of them, and part of the problem that this person identified was that there was something of an echo chamber among the younger members of the group who did not see anything wrong with some of the behavior that was emerging, who maybe even endorsed it or defended Haim. And it was incumbent upon some of the older members of the group to identify the behavior as grooming or child predating, and they took it upon themselves to try to interrupt it. The other piece of this is that it all happened relatively quickly. The girl, from their recollection, joined the server March 5th or 6th. The two were online dating or had expressed that they were dating by the 15th or so of the month. And then last Thursday, he came to New Jersey from Florida to meet with her.
Was there any attempt along the way to notify her parents or others in the community, law enforcement?
So last Monday, members of the group began circulating a form message to everyone that they could find on Heim's Facebook friends list. And they said, we think this is what's going on. Here's a link to a page of captured screenshots where we've logged this engagement between the two of them. They believe they got in contact with the uncle of the guy who was doing this stuff. And they believe that from there, it may have led to him killing the server, which he did the next day.
Matt, are there any content restrictions coming from Discord?
As far as I can tell, there isn't. Discord says it has an abuse email address for reporting bullying, harassment, and other issues, and a 24-hour response team. From the information gathered by the people who were in the group who attempted to notify authorities, the guy had deleted the server on Tuesday, and Discord did not get back to them until a day or so afterwards, at which point they already reported that the deletion had made their forensic efforts more difficult. And as we know, on Thursday at noon, Haim had already arrived in New Jersey and met with the girl after her school.
To what extent is this unique and specific to the Discord app?
I have no way of knowing that. I feel like any online community in which minors can connect with adults or fellow teens, this kind of thing could happen. In fact, the thing I was most taken with in covering on this story is that your child may only be as safe as the most responsible adult in the room. And there were a couple of them here who made those efforts, but due to the nature of the way that this conversation was going, the girl's youth, and the fact that only one of the other members in the group apparently was a friend she had from her hometown, it made it very difficult to connect with her or with her family.
As we speak, I suppose the only good news on the face of it is that this 12-year-old girl from Collingswood is physically safe.
She's home. Her mother said she is experiencing symptoms of PTSD, which is eminently understandable. The mom said she's getting all kinds of support and all kinds of services. She was very grateful to law enforcement. She was very grateful to the members of the community who worked to try to stop this behavior while it was happening. And mostly right now, the family is asking for privacy while they try to regroup and get their daughter the care that she needs.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us and bringing this story to light.
Thanks for having me.
NJ Penn reporter Matt Skoufalos on Newsworks Tonight. A debate is raging in Delaware over a proposal to create a statewide anti-discrimination policy for schools. Though some provisions related to transgender students have ignited heated debate, as WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
Maddie Heaney knew long before starting school that she was a girl, despite the body she was born with and her boy's name. From an early age, she wore girl's clothes and was, in her mind, a princess.
There wasn't a doubt about it. And then as I got older, went into preschool, kindergarten, I noticed people didn't think of me as a girl. And I would get weird looks when I would play dress up or do things that were normal to me.
Maddie's sense of self began wavering by third grade, when the boys kept quizzing the classmate who looked but didn't act like them.
Why are you playing with the girls? Why are you playing with stuffed animals and Barbies? Why don't you play sports with us and everything? And that's when I sort of felt very uncomfortable and became really depressed. And I sort of tried to make myself more masculine than I was and tried being the complete opposite person that I was to please everyone around me. It was probably the lowest point of my life. It was awful.
But with the blessings of her family, in fifth grade, Maddie formally began her transition to a girl. In June, she will graduate from Wilmington's Cab Calloway School of the Arts, where she majors in drama and classmates and staff alike embrace her. While Maddie is now making plans to transition to college, a debate is raging in Delaware educational circles about how other transgender kids are treated in public schools. The controversy revolves around the draft policy of a statewide anti-discrimination regulation sought by Governor John Carney. Known as Regulation 225, it's generated 11,000 written comments, most in opposition. The key point of contention is a provision that allows schools to not notify parents if a transgender student wants to use a different name than at home. To do so, schools would first be required to consider the student's, quote, safety, health, and well-being. Nicole Tice, who heads the Delaware Family Policy Council, has led the opposition.
If this were to be implemented in our schools, we would allow students with no age stipulation, so as young as 4 and 5 years old, to really explore the idea of being an opposite gender or not. And if a parent is deemed unsupportive of that, very easily the school system could decide to get around the parent and begin to interact with that child very differently than their biological reality.
Tice and her allies vow to sue the state and districts that adopt such a policy.
Whatever it takes to really preserve parental authority, will be all in.
The umbrella groups for state school boards and superintendents also have concerns about the draft policy. Another vehement foe is state lawmaker Rich Collins, a Republican from Sussex County.
I do not believe that our schools should be in the business of getting into our little children's minds all the way down to age five and convincing them that they should live in a way that maybe their parents would not agree with. We're talking about a major change in how our schools would operate. One of the largest policy changes maybe in the history of this state.
It's not just the part related to parents that is polarizing. There is also widespread controversy over the section that says schools will provide access to locker rooms and bathrooms that match the students' gender identity. Opposing views were on raw display during a boisterous meeting in February of the team Carney appointed to develop the policy.
You have not the power to dictate what amounts to the emancipation of our children without the consent of their parents, and also without the legal or constitutional authority to do so.
A 12-year-old trans girl does not put the community at risk by using the ladies' room.
The parents who are probably having the biggest problem with this are more than likely the parents who would not accept these children.
Wilmington lawyer Mark Papora, a development team member who helped draft the proposed policy, says many states have enacted similar provisions with little fanfare. He says the provision allowing schools to bypass parents would only be used on rare occasions, if at all.
There were people who were very concerned about the safety of some students, in particular transgender students, whose parents may not support them, may not agree that they're transgender. And so we thought that that was potentially harmful to students, that it would jeopardize their safety and well-being if the parent was notified before the child was ready to tell the parent about their gender identity. It's very important to LGBT people to have control over who they come out to and when they come out to them. Because frankly, your world can change in a second.
Maddie's stepmother, Andrea Rashbaum, is on the policy development team. She's not surprised by the backlash. She's experienced it firsthand.
We lost friends. We didn't talk to family for a while. And people would say to us, like, well, for our event, could he come as a boy? Because, you know, he's a boy. And I would say, no, she's a girl, and she's going to come as a girl.
But Maddie persevered, and with the help of counseling and medical treatments, is thriving. She uses the girls' bathrooms and locker rooms at school without drama.
It's, like, essential that I have the safety, and every trans kid has the safety, to be themselves, use the bathroom that they want, use the pronouns that they want, be called the name they want. Yeah, it's just a human right. In situations where parents might not be accepting, school might be a safe haven for them. It might be a place where they don't feel as judged.
Carney has stated his commitment to schools that are, quote, welcoming, inclusive places. But because there is so much opposition, Rashbaum's panel is still deliberating whether to make changes. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
This week, the Philadelphia Orchestra premieres a new musical composition about Philadelphia. The commission piece was inspired by thousands of audio clips crowdsourced from city residents. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the symphony gets at the good, the bad, and the ugly of Philadelphia.
Todd Macover of Boston composes city symphonies. He lands in a city, explores it through an audio recorder and hundreds of interviews with residents to compose a large-scale piece of music. He's done this in Toronto, in Detroit, Edinburgh, Perth, among others. He prefers places where he can weigh the good and the bad. He says places populated by people who believe they live in a perfect city make him uncomfortable.
But here, you see all the sides of what's possible all the time. You know, you can't get away from it. It's all mixed up here, which is, I think, really powerful.
And when we get rid of that meat, we fry more meat.
To make Philadelphia Voices, Macover introduced a mobile phone app that allows anyone to record a sound and upload it into a database. He collected about 8,000 sounds, which, directly or indirectly, influenced the music he wrote. The music is written for a full orchestra and a 250-voice choir. That's a big sound. The libretto for the chorus was also crowdsourced, coming from several Philadelphia writers, including teenagers, in an after-school program. Macover visited the Mighty Writers in West Philadelphia, where he asked the young people to spend 10 minutes writing about Philadelphia.
When I write, I don't really pay attention to what I'm writing. I just want to get stuff out there.
That's Jaina Hepburn, and she writes a lot. At just 16, she already has under her belt many, many short stories, novellas, two full-length novels. She labors over them, editing and rewriting. Her poetry, on the other hand, she writes completely in the moment.
I don't know what else I could change about it. I feel like when I wrote it, I was feeling like this is what I have to say, and this is what I have to get out there. Going back to it would feel like I'm kind of restricting myself. It's very much so a product of an emotion that was felt at a very specific period in time.
Hepburn wrote about the conspicuous wealth of Rittenhouse Square, the gentrifying coffee shops of University City, angry commuters on SEPTA, trash clogging the streets everywhere.
Then it ended with this idea of waiting for morning to love again. It was the first time she mentioned love in the poem. I didn't tell people to talk about love, but the idealism and, you know, caring about others, a kind of social conscience, is in the core of this city, even if it's sometimes hidden and sometimes difficult.
Macover took two poems by Hepburn and texts by other writers, set them to music. Hepburn couldn't believe what her words sounded like.
Like, it's like straight up like an out-of-body experience. But seeing my work kind of on this scale, not just gave a poem life, but really made a piece of the city. It really does take me out of it. It makes me proud to be from here, and it makes me so thankful and feel so blessed to actually have a lot of people care so much about this thing or these two things that I wrote.
Philadelphia Voices will be performed three times this week, and then next week, the whole ensemble, all 350 musicians, will take their Philly show to play New York's Carnegie Hall. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Perhaps obscured by the Eagles, Wildcats, supernova, and the 76ers surge, the Flyers control their own destiny in advance of the NHL playoffs, which get underway Wednesday. Let's learn where that destiny might take them with Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer Sam Carcitti. Sam, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
So, two games left. Is there a chance that the Flyers won't make the playoffs?
There's a slight chance they would really have to collapse. There are no guarantees right now, but they're in the driver's seat. They control their own destiny. If they have a win and an overtime or a shootout loss, they'll be in, and regardless of what the other teams do. So they're in pretty good shape, and the good news is they're going to get Brian Elliott, the number one goalie, back Thursday night against Carolina. So that should give the team an emotional lift, and it also gives them their top goaltender back in the net.
Some are pointing to a lackluster performance in their most recent game, though if you take a longer look, I think since early December, the Flyers have, what, the NHL's fifth-best record?
Yeah, that's true. Since December 4th, they have the fifth-best record. After they lost 10 in a row, they were buried in the standings. At that time, only two teams had fewer points than the Flyers, but since then they've taken off. Generally, in the last 4 months, they've played very well, and from my way of thinking, they deserve to get in the playoffs, but they have to finish it off here. They don't want the 4 months of real solid work to go down the drain.
If the Flyers could truly control their fate, who might they prefer to face in the first round?
Well, there are a lot of possibilities right now as to whom they will face. I think Boston and Tampa Bay are teams they want to avoid. But if they did finish at the second wild card, that's who they would face, one of those two teams. I think they would prefer, it might sound strange, they probably would prefer to face Washington if they could pick their team, even though Washington won the Metropolitan Division. They played very well against Washington. They won 3 or 4 games, scored a lot of goals against the Capitals, and they seem to match up well against them. They have not matched up well against the Penguins. That's another possibility. Columbus is another possibility. They've played even games against the Blue Jackets, but they're the main teams that are in the running right now.
If we dare to look past this season with the current roster, do they set up well for an even further march toward the Stanley Cup next season?
I think they do. I mean, this is a team that's going to have some cap space in the off season, and I think they'll add either a winger or a center in the off season, possibly both. It remains to be seen what they'll do with Wayne Simmons. There's a chance they could trade him and try to get younger, try to get some draft picks. He has 1 year left on his contract, but they have a slew of prospects coming. And, you know, I think the players you see now, the young players, guys like Ivan Provorov and Travis Sanheim and Oscar Lindblom, you know, they're going to just get better. And they have played a lot of young players this year, and Nolan Patrick is another one. And, you know, these guys are growing right before our eyes, and I think they're going to get better. So I think good times are ahead for this team.
Who would have thought even a year or two ago that Philadelphia as a whole would be experiencing this sports renaissance?
Yeah, it's amazing. I think it's a little contagious. I think that there's something to the fact that, the other teams bring energy to each other. I know the Flyers were at the Eagles NFC Championship game. Almost all the Flyers were there sitting in the stands, and they become friends with the Eagles, and they see how they, you know, what they did, how they re-energized the city, and I think they want to be a part of that. It reminds me of 1980, back when I think all four teams were in the championship game, and I don't think that's going to happen this year, but it's certainly pointing in the right direction.
Well, if it's contagious, let's hope there's no cure at hand.
There you go.
Sam, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the time.
Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer Sam Carcitti on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.